It's my pleasure to welcome you to this session, Government Assistance Programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security Income. This afternoon's session will be presented by Mr. William Leach. Mr. Leach is employed by PSA Access, the national nonprofit organization that assists persons with certain rare chronic conditions, including primary immune disorders. PSA Access services are provided at no cost to their clients. Mr. Leach is a licensed Florida attorney from Tampa. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Leach.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is William Leach, and as indicated, I'm from an organization called PSA Access. And I always like to start with a quote from the woman who founded our program, Rachel Warner, who said that knowledge is the key to fighting the fear associated with chronic illness. And so my goal here today is to try to provide you with the knowledge to confront some of these things that are sometimes confusing or scary simply because you're not familiar with them. Try to familiarize you with it a little bit to take some of the strangeness out of it, if you will. We're part of Patient Services Incorporated, advocating for chronic conditions, entitlements, and social services is where we get the access from. And as far as our organization is concerned, we have over 20 years of experience representing people nationwide on their federal disability claims. We also work with people in helping them understand how to coordinate benefits through things like COBRA, the Affordable Care Act. We can also guide you to other resources that might be of assistance to your family, other types of insurance programs or assistance programs. And all of our services are confidential and provided at no cost. You know, as I say, we're a nonprofit organization. We deal with a number of different communities. Primary immune deficiency is one of the major ones. About 25% of our current caseload is primary immune deficiency. So we also work with the other disease states listed. And what I want to start off by talking about, I used to do this presentation talking about disability first, and people would kind of look at me and say, why are we talking about that? And the reason why we're talking about disability is because of what's on the screen, which is Medicare and Medicaid, because that's your avenue to getting to Medicare or Medicaid coverage if you're not otherwise qualified for those programs. It can also have an impact on continuation of coverage under COBRA, and it also has an impact under the Affordable Care Act in the marketplace in terms of whether or not you're considered disabled or not, or whether you're Medicare or Medicaid eligible or not. So I want to start with the basics in case you're not familiar with these two programs. We talk about Medicare and Medicaid, and sometimes people think they're the same thing, and they're not. They're two different programs, and as you're going to see, there's some fairly significant differences in how you get to one or the other, as well as what they do. Medicare pays a portion of your hospital and medical costs, but it can have some pretty significant out-of-pocket costs that are not covered unless you have secondary coverage. That's what they call Medigap or a Medicare supplement policy. Traditional Medicare does not have a prescription drug benefit, although that's now available through the Part D plan. There's only two ways to qualify for Medicare. You must be either 65 or older, or you must be eligible to receive Social Security disability benefits. And understand that Social Security disability, not the other program we're going to talk about. And even there, you don't get Medicare right away. There's a 29-month waiting period before you become eligible for Medicare under Social Security disability rules. And we were just talking about the supplements. Part A basically is part of traditional Medicare. It covers hospitalizations. There is no premium. It's typically automatic. In other words, you don't have to sign up for it. Part B, however, is optional because they will charge you a premium for that. It's a little over $100 a month, although it can vary according to your income. And that covers mostly physician and medical costs, outpatient. It can also, in many instances, cover your infusion drugs. In many states, a person who has Medicare Part A or Part B can purchase a Medicare supplement to cover their out-of-pocket costs under Medicare. Under Medicare, for example, Part B, IVIG is typically only reimbursed at 80% of the cost, so you still have a 20% out-of-pocket. Those of you who are familiar with immunoglobulin will know that 20% of that is still a lot of money. Again, not all plans are available in all states, and some are only available people age 65 and older, so there are separate markets in each state for the supplements. Medicare Part C is something that a lot of you probably heard of as a Medicare Advantage plan or Medicare Complete plan. It basically takes the place of traditional Medicare and often offers additional benefits, things that Medicare does not cover, like hearing aids or glasses or dentures. Some of these plans may also include a prescription drug benefit. And again, it varies from plan to plan. The plans are offered by private insurers. but very often these plans come with a limited provider network. In other words, you can't go to just any doctor with them. You only go to the doctors that are in that network. And then Part D is what I was talking about earlier, the prescription drug plan. And these, again, are offered through private insurers, not through the government. There's a range of plans available in each state, and the costs vary according to what type of coverage you get. There's a good tool on the Medicare website if you ever get in a situation where you need to start choosing a Medicare prescription drug plan. It will ask you to put in your prescriptions, and it will help you find the drug plan that works best in your situation. Enrollment in the drug plan is voluntary. You don't have to sign up for it, but if you don't, there's a penalty. They can charge you basically 1% per month for every month that you don't enroll after you become Medicare eligible. And you can also be required to wait for what's called open enrollment, which occurs the last couple of months of the year. And people who have both Medicare and Medicaid, sort of a special situation, will be automatically enrolled in a prescription drug plan. If you're in that situation, it makes more sense to go in and do it yourself rather than let the state do it for you, because they may not necessarily pick the best plan for your situation. Medicaid, different animal. Medicaid covers most medical and hospital expenses with little or no out-of-pocket for the patient. This is a plan that is administered jointly by the federal government and each individual state. And so you're going to have 50 different flavors, one for each state, where they're all very similar but not always identical. In most states, if you're eligible for at least $1 worth of supplemental security income, now this is different than Social Security Disability. This is another program that we're going to talk about more. But if you're eligible for at least $1 worth of supplemental security income, then that would automatically entitle you to Medicaid in most states. In other states, you may have to qualify separately, and the financial guidelines may be different. Now, under the Affordable Care Act, some states have expanded Medicaid to include everyone up to 138% of the federal poverty level. In the states that have not done that, there's a coverage gap, basically, for people that are caught between Medicaid and being able to go into the marketplace and get a subsidy in order to be able to afford a plan there. Another program I like to talk about is the Children's Health Insurance Program. Every state has one of these as well. They kind of are similar to Medicaid in that it's a federal plan, but it's coordinated through each state. And they often work very closely with the local Medicaid office. There may be co-payments for certain services, and some states do charge a monthly premium for CHIP coverage. And as I said, it varies from state to state in terms of what's available. Typically, you don't have to pay more than 5% of your income per year in order to cover your children on their children's health insurance program. Like Medicaid, it tends to be means-tested. They look at your family income and assets, but the financial guidelines tend to be not as strict as they are for traditional Medicaid. COBRA is something that basically comes, it's a federal law that says that if you leave your employer or if you're covering someone under your group health insurance policy, that you can continue that policy once you're no longer a covered employee or once you're no longer in the status that entitles you to be covered. And it only applies to employers with 20 or more employees. You can continue for yourself. If you stop working for that employer, you can continue your own coverage for up to 18 months following termination of employment. You have to let them know within 60 days of receiving a COBRA notice that you want that, and then 45 days from that date, you have to pay all premiums due up to that point in order to qualify for it. And here's the kicker on that, is that when you work for the employer typically pays a substantial portion of your group health care costs. Under COBRA, you're paying the entire cost plus an additional 2% administrative fee. So the good news is that you can get COBRA. The bad news is that it can tend to be kind of expensive. And again, this is typically a situation where if it's covered worker, the covered worker is no longer working. That's why they went on COBRA, because they're no longer able to work. Here's how these play together. You can extend COBRA for an additional 11 months for a total of 29, provided that Social Security finds you disabled within 60 days of, finds that you became disabled within 60 days of the date that you terminated employment. You're still in that initial 18 months of COBRA, and you notify the COBRA provider within 60 days of getting the decision from Social Security. Now, what that does, we talked earlier about the fact that if you are trying to qualify for Medicare, then from the time you stop working and become disabled to the time you can get your Medicare card, it's a 29-month waiting period. So COBRA would ordinarily run out before you ever got to that. With the extension, that gives you a total of 29 months of coverage, so you can basically stop working, go on COBRA, stay on COBRA until you reach Medicare eligibility, and then you're on Medicare. There's also an important wrinkle about the marketplace in this. Unfortunately, it happens a lot that you're applying for Social Security disability and it takes them longer than 18 months to make a decision in your case, which means your cover has now run out. What do you do now? If your cover expires outside of the normal open enrollment period for the marketplace, you get a special enrollment period. In other words, you can sign up right then. You don't have to wait until the end of the year when they open enrollment again. That only applies, though, if your COBRA has actually been used up. If you simply stop paying for it, if you're still entitled to COBRA but you just can't afford it anymore, that will not get you a special enrollment period. And then from the marketplace, you can find out if there's a qualified health plan, Medicaid, or the Children's Health Insurance Program, if we're talking about children, to see if you're eligible for coverage under any of those programs. Talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act. I know it's been covered more extensively in other presentations, but open enrollment for that is from November 15th to February 15th. And then during the open enrollment period, even if you still got COBRA left, you can drop COBRA and switch if you can do better financially doing that. So if you're on COBRA, that's the point where you want to look at and see, can I save myself some money by switching over to a marketplace plan, assuming that I can get comparable coverage. So your COBRA does not need to be exhausted at that point in order to sign up in the marketplace. And this just talks about marketplace eligibility, lawful resident, and otherwise ineligible for Medicare and Medicaid, CHIP. There's tax credits available for people within a certain income range. There is third-party premium assistance usually available, although as you've probably heard, there's some challenges with that in terms of some insurers not wanting to accept that. And let's move on. So basically, we try to help Kate stay on track. You've got a lot of different options here in terms of the Affordable Care Act, CHIP, COBRA, SSI, Medicaid, Social Security, Disability, Medicare. Purpose of our program is trying to help you sort through the different options and see what makes the most sense for your particular situation. And so now we're going to talk about the disability programs. There are, again, like Medicare and Medicaid, there are two of them. They are the same in some regards and different in some regards. We're going to talk about the differences first. Social Security Disability and Supplemental Security Income, as it says here, this is a general overview. Like anything written by lawyers, there are exceptions to exceptions, so I understand I'm generalizing a lot of this stuff. Social Security Disability is for people who have a recent work history, generally within the past 5 years, and you've paid Social Security taxes on their income. The property that you own, other family income, does not affect your eligibility. You can have the biggest house in the world, you can own property in Hawaii, it doesn't make any difference. This is strictly based on your work history. But it's based on your work history, not your spouse's. And the other thing is, as it says here, is that you have to have worked recently. I've talked to a couple of people just at this conference who have stopped working in the last couple of years, and I pointed out to them that after 5 years, they're not going to be covered by Social Security disability anymore once they've stopped working. And then the monthly payment is based on how much you earned and how long you worked. Contrast that with supplemental security income. First of all, it's for people who are too young to work. Children can't get Social Security disability in most instances, but they can qualify for supplemental security income. The supplemental security income, or SSI, is for people with very, very limited financial resources. The financial guidelines are pretty tight on those. And so your other family income, like your spouse's income or your parents' income, does affect whether or not you're going to be eligible for that program or not. We talked a little bit about the fact that Social Security Disability has a 5-month waiting period and an additional 24 months for Medicare. And that's from the day that you first became disabled or that they deemed you to first become disabled. Once you've satisfied that waiting period, you can't get back benefits up to 12 months prior to the day that you applied. So if you waited a little while to see if maybe I can go back to work, the other thing I tell people is take a look at it when you're getting close to about 12 months out from the time that you last worked and ask yourself realistically, do you think you're really going to be able to go back? Because once you start going beyond that 12-month mark, you're basically leaving potential benefits on the table that you might otherwise be eligible for. And then as we discussed, 24 months after you become entitled to your first Social Security disability check, then you get your Medicare card. Medicaid goes with supplemental security income. They're like two different pairs, if you will. There's no waiting period. Your first month of eligibility is the month after the month in which you applied for disability benefits. And again, the only thing you have to show is that you're eligible for at least $1 worth of SSI benefits in order to get Medicaid in most states. In a few states, you have to apply separately. And then sometimes you can get both. This is a situation where you have someone who's only worked part-time or has worked sporadically or perhaps seasonally. They don't have a very long work history. They're not quite eligible for the maximum amount from Social Security disability. Supplemental security income pays roughly about $750 a month. So if your Social Security disability benefit is below that, SSI can kick in to sort of bring you up to that threshold. And then again, some people will qualify in that five-month waiting period for Social Security disability, where they'll get SSI during the waiting period, and then once Social Security kicks in, the SSI drops out because they're now getting more from that than they would from SSI. Those folks can get both Medicare and Medicaid, but how those benefits interact with each other varies a lot from state to state. So far I've talked about how the programs are different. What I want to talk about now is how the programs are alike, because both programs, Social Security Disability and Supplemental Security Income, use the same medical rules to determine whether or not you're disabled or not. And have given here the rather lengthy definition that Social Security has for disability. They say that disability is the inability to do any substantial gainful activity by reason of any medically determinable physical or mental impairment which can be expected to result in death or which has lasted or can be expected to last for a continuous period of not less than 12 months. You can tell that a lawyer wrote this, okay? So here's the five steps that they sort of go through to kind of flesh that out a little bit to talk about, well, how do we figure all that out, what's in that definition? There's five points that they go through. The first question they ask is whether you're engaged in what they call substantial gainful activity. The next question they ask is whether or not you have what they define as a severe medical impairment. The third question is, does that impairment meet what we call the listing of impairments? There's a special section of the regulations. There is one for primary immune deficiency that we will talk about. If the person does not meet a listing, then we go on to steps four and five. At step four, we ask whether, given your it's residual functional capacity to perform your past relevant work, or given your age, your education, your work experience, is there other types of work that you could perform? So I start with the first five, or the first two of the five. What is substantial gainful activity? As of 2015, if you work and gross more than $1,090 per month, you're considered not disabled based on the income alone. Now, flip that around. What that means is that if you're applying for disability, you can still work and earn a very minimal income. You could run up to like $1,080 a month gross before deductions and still qualify for a disability benefit. That can be very important in terms of trying to wait them out for that five-month waiting period, or you have to go through a lengthy appeal process trying to get your claim approved. For severe impairment, I'm going to tell you that pretty much anybody diagnosed with any primary immune deficiency by definition has a severe impairment. It has to be anything that has more than a minimal impact on your ability to function or your ability to work, and anybody with primary immune deficiency is pretty much going to pass that test. Now, the third one is an interesting one. This is the one called the listing of impairments. It's basically a listing of many but not all medical conditions. And they sort of lump all the various types of immune deficiency together. They just refer to it as cell-mediated immune deficiency. And if you win at step three, we don't go on to steps four and five. Basically, it's a shortcut to yes. If you get turned down on step three, you still go on to steps four and five, but you still have the potential to win in one of the later steps of the process. The listing for primary immune deficiency has three different sections, three choices, if you will, for how you show that you meet the listing. The first one talks about recurrent severe infections that are resistant to treatment or require hospitalization or IV treatment three or more times in a 12-month period. When it says IV treatment, it's not really spelled out in the regulations, but I interpret that as IV antibiotics, that if you're having to either do that or go into the hospital more than three times in a 12-month period, that can be an indication of disability. But it has to be one of the listed infections that they're talking about. The one that we're probably most familiar with at the end is sinusitis, but the others that they look at are sepsis, meningitis, pneumonia, septic arthritis, or endocarditis. If you have any of these infections repeatedly, that can show that you're disabled, provided you're doing either IV antibiotics at least three times within a 12-month period, or you've been hospitalized at least three times within a 12-month period. Or, Part B, this is for SCID where if you're having a stem cell transplant, you're presumed to be disabled for at least 12 months after the transplant, just automatically. And then after that, they evaluate you in terms of what residual problems you have after that 12-month period to see if you're still disabled or not. And then the final one is the one I like to call the IDF paragraph, because this paragraph was added several years ago as a result of lobbying and education done by the Immune Deficiency Foundation. They brought in a bunch of people with immune deficiency and educated Social Security on what it means to have an immune deficiency. And so this is the result of that. And I will tell you that this language has now been carried forward into some of the other listings as well, where they're looking at how does this really affect the person, is the question that they're asking. And so this section is looking for repeated manifestations of an immune deficiency disorder with at least two constitutional symptoms. They list several here. The two that we usually end up talking about with immune deficiency are fatigue, that being tired or not having any energy, and then something called malaise, which is the achy, flu-like, feel-like crap syndrome is basically how I describe it. Many of the people that I talk to that have immune deficiencies will tell me that these are basically chronic features of their daily lives, that they do these on a regular basis, and that's what we're talking about. Now, as a result of those two or more constitutional symptoms, you have to be able to show that you're limited in one of these three areas to a marked degree. That can be activities of daily living. That's things like grocery shopping, household chores, washing the dishes, anything that's just a normal part of daily life. Another one that's kind of key for folks with immune deficiency is maintaining social functioning. A lot of people, in order to avoid infections, don't go out much. They stay at home. They avoid crowds. If that's to the degree that it's marked, that could be an indication of disability. And then the final one is just completing tasks in a timely manner. That's basically the question I ask to the woman who's telling me, oh, I still do all the stuff around the house. You're telling me you're still doing the laundry. If it goes into the washing machine today, does it go into the dryer the same day? And if it does it get folded on the same day? And what they will often tell me is that, I have to kind of stretch it out. And that's, again, another example of what we're talking about here. Taking things and doing them at a slower pace, you can still do them. It just takes you longer. And if that's to the point, again, that it's marked, that could show that you have a severely disabling condition due to immune deficiency. So even if you don't meet the listing, we then go on to look at, first of all, your past work to see if you can still do that type of work. And they rate your work in terms of two things. They look at, first of all, how physical is it? Is it sedentary? Is it light? Is it heavy? That involves how much walking, standing, lifting, and carrying is involved in the job. And then how much training do you have to have? Is it something you can do with no training at all, or do you have to have an advanced degree or several years of education in order to be able to do it? If you can still do the work that you've done in the past, given your limitations, step three is a shortcut to yes. Step four is a shortcut to no. We don't go to step five. If you can still do your past relevant work, they're going to say, okay, well, you can still do work you've done in the past, so we're going to find that you're not disabled. But if they say, okay, we agree that you can't do the work that you've done before, then the final question they're going to ask is whether or not there's any work you could perform that exists in the national economy. And understand that this can be jobs that pay a lot less than what you're accustomed to earning. These are jobs that, although they may exist in the national economy, may not necessarily exist right around the corner from where you live. So it's kind of an ivory tower analysis. The things that they look at in terms of work-related activities can be the things like we talked about before, lifting, carrying, walking, and standing, as well as concentration, persistence, and pace. The key thing is the last sentence on this slide. Almost everybody that I talk to that has an immune deficiency says, I could probably work a little bit. The problem is I can't do it consistently. I would miss too much time. And I will tell you that typically if you're going to miss more than 2 days per month due to treatment, side effects of treatment, illness, doctor's visits, if that's your situation, that to me is evidence of disability. Now, I also tell you that's typically going to be a case that has to go up on appeal. The local office typically will not approve those cases, but once we get those cases in front of the judge, more often than not, the judge approves those claims. So how do you apply for disability? There's three different ways. The easiest one is the one I listed first. If you're comfortable going online, you can do it at the website, which is www.ssa.gov. There's a link on that page that says apply for disability. It takes you directly to the application. You can also call them at their toll-free number, 1-800-772-1213. It's a bit of a phone tree maze in order to get to the disability option, but it can be done. And the one that I usually do not recommend for people with impaired immune systems is to go to the Social Security office and apply in person, because there's usually a lot of other people there, and many of them also have health problems, and that's probably not your preferred way. It depends on where you live. If you live in a small town, it may not be as much of an issue. The date that you first contact them, they will use as your what they call your protective filing date for determining when your disability benefits could begin. So who decides your claim? Initially, it goes through a state disability determination service. Like some of these other things we've been talking about, although Social Security Disability is a federal program, it's jointly administered with the states, and the first part of the process is handled by a state agency. I will tell you that the state agencies averaged out nationwide turned down about 2 out of 3 of all applications. So most people get told no when they apply for disability benefits. Many states have a level of review called reconsideration. It's another level of review by the same state agency that turned you down the first time. Shockingly, that same agency will turn you down about 80 to 90% of the time. So reconsideration is pretty much a rubber stamp of what happened on the first go-around. The third step, though, takes you out of the state system and into the federal system. There's something called the Office of Disability Adjudication and Review. That is where most cases are won. When I first started doing this, the judges were approving about 2 out of 3. We've seen that steadily nosedive over the years. It's now down to a little bit below 50%, but it's still better than the local office. The good news is that most cases are won at the hearing level. The bad news is that it can take a long time to get there. Most of the hearing offices have at least a 12-month backlog, if not more, of scheduling hearings. And this is a little chart. I'm not sure how visible that is for you guys, but it shows what I was just talking about, at each stage how many are approved and how many are disallowed. There's also another level I didn't talk about, the appeals council. If you're turned down by your local judges, a panel of judges in Falls Church, Virginia, here's the appeals from there, and they reverse what the local judge did 2% of the time. So again, they're kind of a rubber stamp. The key level in this is the administrative law judge, because that's where most cases are won, and that's where, frankly, our office does most of our work, because we go out and represent people at the local level with their local judge when we go out and represent them at the hearing. So here's some general things you need to think about if you're going to apply for disability benefits. And the first one is what I was talking about earlier, that if you delay filing benefits, you're potentially leaving benefits behind that you might otherwise be eligible for. So you really, like I said, once you get to about a year out, you still actually have, I would say, it's 17 months is the drop dead date, because remember, there's a 5-month waiting period anyway. But once you start getting like to 18 months out, there's benefits that are going to drop off the back end that you might have otherwise been eligible for if you hadn't, because again, you can only pay retroactively 12 months prior to your application. Key things, I can't tell you how many times we run into this, keep your address up to date if you move, which often happens because your financial circumstances have changed. Let Social Security know, or if you have an attorney, let your lawyer know so that we can let Social Security know that you've moved to a different address. Surviving financially is the big one, because again, you've stopped working or you've reduced your income to below that $1,000 a month threshold. What the heck are you going to do as far as paying bills? I've had clients that were living in their vehicles by the time we got to hearing. I have adult parents that moved in with their adult children because they couldn't pay the mortgage anymore. So I've seen some really hard case stories in terms of what to do in that situation. So you may have to, if you have it available, if a long-term disability policy can be a godsend in that situation. Not everybody has those available at work, however. The other things that people fall back on are savings, or the last guy that I represented was basically just his family was supporting him. They were paying all his bills for him because he didn't have any income. Maintaining health coverage is also key. And again, we talked about, you can maintain COBRA, but again, you've stopped working. You have little or no income, and your income and your insurance has now gone from that 20 or 30 or 40% you were paying now to 102%. What are you supposed to do? That kind of gets into the other part of what my organization does. Patient Services Incorporated has premium assistance available for folks with immune deficiency, and that can be a lifesaver in terms of keeping your health insurance in place. And that's important for two reasons. One, just to make sure that you're maintaining your treatment and your access to care. But two, remember that we're basing the determination on what's in your medical records. If you stop seeing the doctor, the judge is going to look at that and say, well, gee, you're not seeing the doctor anymore. You must be able to go back to work because, there's no documentation of your problems. And that brings us to talking to your doctor. A lot of the docs have the idea that they can just write on the – we're going to do questions at the end, okay? A lot of docs have the idea that you give me the 5-minute sign. Oh, thank you. I just realized. Thank you. Okay. I'm just out to the end. Okay. Talk to your doctor if you're going to apply for disability. By law, Social Security has to give great weight to what your doctor says about your ability to work. Specifically, discuss with them that business about the 2 days per month, whether they think you would be able to do something like that. Because if your doctor says no, that could be really good evidence of disability if the case does have to go up on appeal. A lot of docs have the idea that they just write patient is disabled on a prescription pad and hand it to you, that's sufficient. Social Security doesn't pay much attention to just a bald opinion. They want to see the actual documentation. Be thorough and talk about things that you can and can't do. Most zip through this a little bit so we can get to the end and do the questions. Keep a record of which doctors you go to and how often you go to them, specifically names and addresses of the doctors that you go to, because at some point somebody needs to request all those records, and you want to make sure that Social Security gets complete records. So you need to know what Social Security needs to have in order for that to happen. And finally, if you do attempt to work, talk to somebody about it. Make sure that you understand what the rules are, because you can, as I said, still work and apply for disability benefits. But it's a good idea to discuss it with an expert that can get into your specific situation to figure out what works. You may also want to kind of track good days and bad days. A lot of people don't really sit around and think, well, how many bad days do I have in a month? Just take a calendar and start writing down days that if you were trying to work, you'd be picking up the phone that day saying, I can't come in, I can't make it, I've got an infusion today, I'm sick as a dog because I had an infusion yesterday. Just start keeping track of it. By the way, I see a lot of people taking pictures. My email address will be at the end. If you want me to email this presentation to you, I'll be happy to do that. If you get turned down, as we talked about, that's not unusual. Our program is there to assist you with that. As we said, we'll represent you at no cost on your disability claims. And then again, what I usually tell people when they're looking at whether or not to hire a local attorney or not, the local attorney will know your local judges. Me and the other attorney in my program, on the other hand, we're kind of like hired guns coming in from out of town. We rarely see the same judge twice. The difference with us is that, you know, we have a lot of experience working with people with immune deficiency, so we understand the condition really well. So that's kind of the deal, is that with the local attorneys, they may understand Social Security law, but not necessarily the ins and outs of immune deficiencies, particularly the needs for infusion therapy and the like. Social Security doesn't understand any of it. Okay, and then, like I said, the doctor will understand what's going on with you medically, but may not understand how the Social Security system works. So our goal is to kind of bring all those things together and to translate from English to Spanish and Spanish to English, if you will, so that the judge understands medically what's going on with you. And this is, as I said, we're a small program. It's myself, another attorney, Terry Stolovich, our paralegal, Kathy Crow. I talked a little bit about PSI and access. We've both been around since 1989. I've been doing this work since 1991, I think it is, 95. Sorry, 1995. And, let me go back. That's the toll-free numbers, which are, I can provide those. But here's the slide that you want for more information. That's the toll-free number for our office, as well as the fax number. And then my email address at the end, wleach@psiaccess.org. And if you want copies of the presentation or if you have specific questions and you want to call me, you can call me at that number as well. I think that's my last slide. Yep. Okay. I think I made it within my deadline, and we can do questions now.